Welcome, Eagles, to another episode of Trad Cat Night Radio. I'm Eric Kajewski, founder and owner of Trad Cat Night, the most viewed and followed traditional Catholic website worldwide, ranked number one as it relates to traditional Catholicism by Alexa, now top 20,000 website. Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot thank you enough for all your prayers and support. Truly has been a blessing to undertake this apostolate, continue to wake up the masses, expose the New World Order, exposing the infiltration of the Catholic Church. Can't thank you enough. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, but you also hit the notification button. There's a little bell next to it. Apparently, YouTube's thrown another loophole at us where many of you are now being unsubscribed, and that's not me doing it. YouTube apparently is doing it, but they're also now not giving you that notification aspect to where it would be normally going to your email, and it's not doing that anymore. So make sure you do that as well. Make sure you invite all your friends, family, church members to Trad Cat Night. Keep information circulated. Want to thank all those who have picked up my articles and radio broadcasts, including Veterans Today, and for the month of January and probably going into February, I'm putting myself back out there for media appearances. Just finished another one down there with WGSO
down
in New Orleans. And so later this month, we'll be on all kinds of YouTube channels. And it's getting quite interesting with this apostolate. So I appreciate all the opportunities that have come up. And today, we've got another interesting talk with a lot of the topics that we cover here at Trad Cat Night. So a lot of commonality. And today's guest is Tim Kelly. And he is the host of Our Interesting Times, a podcast dedicated to discussing deep state intrigues, parapolitics, conspiracies, and historical revisionism. Mr. Kelly is a graduate of George Mason University with a BA in history. He's married and has been blessed with six children. And so really to get things started off, Tim, first of all, thanks for taking time out and joining us here, you know, on Trad Cat Night. Why don't you tell us, you know, a little bit more about your background, how you got involved with some of the topics that you cover on Our Interesting Times. Maybe tell us a little bit more about this podcast, what you do, types of guests, what you're hoping to accomplish, and then we'll work from there.
Well, as you stated, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Focus of Our Interesting Times, as you stated, was a sort of a bring on guests who do research in, you know, deep state intrigues, parapolitics, historical revisionism. This is sort of type of research which confronts the official narratives and stories we've been given regarding our country and also world history in general. This involves some, you know, delving into some, you know, the more, I guess, well-known conspiracy theories or controversial topics like the various assassinations like John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but also the deep state interests that were behind those political acts. Also getting into some sort of a reinterpretation of history, particularly the world wars, what really caused them, the narratives that were spun out of those wars, how they were used to shape our culture and form what we call today the modern world. And the reason why I started doing it was after years of just sort of reading other people's materials. I don't really present any groundbreaking research myself. I sort of aggregate the information and sort of collect it and collate it and use it hopefully bring on the guests that do the research and ask them the questions, and hopefully my audience gets something out of it. So that's kind of what drove me. Now, what really got me into it probably culmination of a series of events. I started having doubts about the official narrative of things, probably starting in the 1990s when the Cold War ended, and of course the Berlin Wall came down, but NATO didn't go away. And then there's 2001, of course, the seminal event of the terrorist attacks, now referred to as 9/11, and that sort of got me looking into various conspiracy theories, things I kind of dabbled and were interested in. I spent the better part of a decade just sort of investigating and reading as much as I could in my free time. And a little less than 2 years ago, I decided not to be afraid of the technology. So I kind of surmounted the not so high technical hurdles to start my own podcast. I'm still learning how to work those out. And so if I keep waiting until I'm an expert, I'll never do it.
Right.
And I figured I've read enough that I could ask some cogent questions and offer something to the public to listen to. And so I decided to do my own podcast, and that's how it got started. And I found out that a lot of people are available. They want to talk.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm finding the same thing. And, you know, I had a wide swath of people wanting me to get you on the show. So your information is certainly being circulated. It's being heard, which is a good thing in this information world. We'll get into that maybe a little bit more down the line. Now, out of all of these mainstream narratives, if you will, if we could break this down, you know, what is the most interesting area of study, if you will, within the realm of our interesting times? Is it 9/11? Is it the Holocaust? Is it the assassinations? Is it the false flag? I mean, is there a certain area that you like to key in on?
I kind of cover all those topics. There's some that are more difficult than others, particularly delving into the Holocaust narrative and the problems with that narrative is a touchy subject.
Oh, yeah.
In some countries, you go to jail for it. In this country, you just sort of get ostracized.
At least for now.
It's getting more traction now, which I think I probably have the powers to be upset. Because from that narrative, so much has been done in the name, you know, of the Holocaust, the so-called Holocaust. And quite often, when you even question it, you get labeled a Nazi or denier. All of those. I'm not really denying it. I'm trying to understand it and explain it. Very few people argue that nothing happened, that people didn't suffer.
Right.
It's just that what we were told happened is a gross exaggeration for political purposes. And if you understand that the first casualty of war is always the truth, that's not too difficult to understand how that was done. It's not a impossibility considering the propaganda machineries that are created around wars to spin narratives, you know, to justify all the destruction that war brings, you know, so.
Yeah, and that's just it. You nailed it right on the head there in terms of, you know, I'm right there with you. I certainly question the mainstream narrative. I don't believe, you know, 6 million Jews died. I don't believe there was gas chambers, but that's not to say that nothing happened. And so immediately you get thrown into the Hitler category, you get thrown into the, you know, neo-Nazi and all this, and it truly is brainwash, and that's what we want to cover a little bit more today with my guest Tim Kelly. You know, you say our interesting times, but we also could say our deceiving times, I guess, where truth has become lies, and lies, if you repeat them often enough, become truth. Within, you know, this kind of overall realm of moving from a Christian society out into this new age, what's the biggest area of concern do you think that, you know, many Americans are kind of overlooking? I know with the Trump election, many think that we're going to kind of move back in the right direction. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, your take on the post-election analysis. But is there an area that we're kind of overlooking here in this end game?
I don't know if it's actually overlooked, but it's not emphasized enough. I do think the issue of the culture, because culture precedes politics, and that's why I think we've been in a culture war probably dating back farther than we know, far, you know, long before the 60s.
Okay.
If you look at the research of Dr. E. Michael Jones is very helpful in this area, because he looks at it as sort of this ethnic warfare and ethnicity, the importance of ethnos in our society, probably sometime around the 19th turn of the century, this large part of this also was America's development into an empire. And so this involves, you know, the Spanish-American War. But the big thing was the First World War, because was the first time that the attempt was made by the powers that be to sort of impose a melting pot, challenge the ethnic divisions that defined America at the time,
right,
and sort of melding into what we call the American, you know, and so they could have their American century, although that was Henry Luce, and that was later in the 30s and 40s. There was an attempt, particularly by the WASP ruling elite, and in partnership with the Jewish elite, to target the growing Catholic population in America, which were largely what, Italian, German, Poles, and Irish. And the problem with America was all the powers that be were overwhelmingly Anglophile. And of course, with the First World War, we were going to war against Germany. And these people were often less than even a generation removed, or maybe a generation removed from the homeland, German homeland. Same with the Irish. The Irish, for many reasons, would not take kindly to going to war on behalf of the British Empire. And so the attempt was made to sort of target the Catholics, because Catholics were thought of as being disloyal or not properly loyal to the war effort. And so although this really, I think, picked up after World War II, it started with the Blanchard brothers, and they published that. I think it was Paul Blanchard who published the book, that American Freedom and Catholic Power. And the theory behind that was that Catholics were, I guess, naturally fascistic or authoritarian. And the only way to change that was to rob them of their Catholic and ethnic identity and produce sort of this bland American. Yeah. And so that's what I think what we got in the 20th, in the middle part of the 20th century, an alliance with the Jews, the Jewish power elite, particularly Hollywood. Oh, because yeah. Because I think Hollywood was the Hollywood moguls, who almost were to a man Jewish, didn't like the fact that the Catholic Church had imposed a production code on them, and they're able to do that because of these ethnic neighborhoods that the Catholic Church derived its political power from. And so, by breaking up these neighborhoods, they were able to weaken the Catholic Church and weaken, you know, do away with ethnic and Catholic identity. And I think E. Michael Jones writes about this a lot in his book, Slaughter of Cities, where this was part of a war planning as a way to solve what he calls as America's nationality issue, and also to supply much-needed labor into the cities. And in the post-war period, this kind of morphed into a very ambitious and sinister psychological warfare social engineering scheme, urban renewal. And along with this was also, they kind of hitched a ride on racial integration and weaponized it to tear apart these ethnic neighborhoods. And the ensuing diaspora produced the white middle class. And once these people have been robbed of their Catholic and ethnic identities, they can be subjected to the psychological warfare that Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and, you know, the educational institutions, the think tanks and such had to offer them. And that's kind of what happened in the 50s and 60s. And we're kind of seeing the bitter harvest of that effort today.
Yeah, another area that, you know, is kind of dear to my heart is this, you know, just the whole sexualization of society. We're constantly being bombarded, not only from mainstream media, but just kind of media in general. I mean, I find it quite prevalent even in alternative media now. You know, just kind of this notion of what I call the disease of me, the promoting of self, you know, the selfies. We're seeing vanity. Of course, Our Lady at Fatima warned us of modesty. You know, we've got soft porn on really not. It's not even at late night television anymore. I mean, you could find it during the middle of the day. But then, of course, just getting into porn and how porn is even evolving and just getting more just I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, there's more and more people hooked on, you know, violent sex and rape and rise in number of watching bestiality. I mean, just. And what I'm trying to say is that the Jews were behind that industry too, as well. In your research and some of the guests that you have brought on, I mean, how important is this notion of, you know, breaking down the moral code to the powers that be?
Yeah, pornography is psychological warfare. Sex is psychological warfare if it can be weaponized. And the idea is you if you incite the passions and appetites, and then you're put yourself in a position to satisfy those passions and appetites, you can control the person. And a man has many masters as he has vices, as St. Augustine said. And I think this is spelled out well in cultural Marxism. I think we kind of refer to today as political correctness, but it really is cultural Marxism. And that grew out of the disillusion that many Marxists had in the during the Great War, the First World War, when the workers dutifully marched off to go get slaughtered in trenches instead of rebelling you know, against their capitalist masters, and they realized that the masses lacked revolutionary conscience. So They realized, you know, in the West that many of these workers were becoming what they, you know, were becoming middle class. They you know, how do you revolutionize someone who has a refrigerator and a car and a radio, right? And so what people like Antonio Gramsci and more interesting, this guy Georg Lukács or Lukács in Hungary said that the enemy was Western culture and more particularly Christianity, and even more particularly Christianity's sexual moral doctrine. And so they decided the way you revolutionize society is you don't go at it directly through ideology, Marxist ideology and all that. You attack the culture. And this began their long march to the institutions. And what's interesting is this guy Lukács in Hungary instituted sex education in public schools in Hungary in 1920 during the short-lived Béla Kun regime. And he was Jewish. The cultural Marxists then migrated to the United States after Hitler came to power in Germany. They established a school in, I think it was Frankfurt. That's why we call it the Frankfurt School. I think it was the new school of learning or something in Frankfurt. And these people went there, I think Columbia University, NYU, and many of them went out to Hollywood. They realized the way you, again, like I said earlier, the way you undermine society's values, Western values, its Christian values, which was the enemy, was you change people's sexual values. You undermine their sexual morality. And this is done, I think it was Herbert Marcuse wrote a book, Eros and Civilization, and also Wilhelm Reich. And these people became very influential. Although Wilhelm Reich died, I think, before 1960, he became very influential in the 1960s in the student rebellion and some of the excesses of the 60s. And that was their idea. You know, again, you undermine people's sexual morality, and that's how you get people to forget their roots, forget morality, forget traditional learning. And that's how you have a revolution.
Yeah, and another way they could outright do it, Tim, is just an outright war on the education system itself. You know, I've had on very prominent guests, Dr. James Pesta, Charlotte Iserbitt, Alex Newman from WND, I think he wrote for The New American, too. Talk a little bit about the dumbification process down. I know that's an intricate part to what we're talking about, too, Common Core. You know, I always just kind of liken it to getting people prepped for like a zombie-like state to ultimately, you know, accept a false new messiah onto the scene. We're seeing now, we'll get into this in a little bit, but, you know, this whole notion that mainstream media is never wrong and that we're fake news and just all this stuff, all this propaganda and brainwash to kind of keep us locked in this dumbified state, if you will. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that area.
Yeah, well, first thing, let me mention one thing about cultural Marxism, that in 1950, the American Jewish Committee published a thing called The Authoritarian Personality. And in that book, pretty much that study stated that America was threatened by fascism primarily because of its Christian majority, particularly the traditional family that was controlled, or at least the traditional family with a strong male father figure. And he had to attack that to ward off fascism. Now, what's interesting is that justified in their minds, you know, basically, if we didn't undermine Christianity, we were faced with another Hitler. And there's that, you know, Holocaust narrative again, justifying their radicalism. But it's interesting to note that Georg Lukács instituted a similar program in Hungary in 1920, long before Hitler ever came to power. So it turns out that was more or less just an excuse. Now, it wasn't just the Jews, of course, because we're talking about the dumbing down of education, producing sort of this mass society of, narcissists and fops and, dumbed down populations. Large influence behind that was people like Aldous Huxley, who was part of the Anglo elite. And he made the observation that as political and economic freedom diminishes, sexual freedom tends to compensatingly increase. So there's that link between sex and freedom, right? If you give in to sexual license, you lose your real freedom. You become enslaved to it. But as far as education goes, you mentioned Charlotte Isby Thompson. I believe that she got access via – was she the one that forwarded that some documents to Anthony Sutton? I think she's one that – her father was a member of Skull and Bones, and she wrote about it in her book, The Dumbing Down of – of America. Was it Dummy Down of America that books you?
Yeah, I can't recall if it was Sutton or not, but yeah. She definitely was passing along information that was very key, I guess you could say, to putting together the pieces of the puzzle in the area of education.
Mm-hmm. And that goes further back, because I think it goes back to the whole idea of compulsory education, which was designed along the Prussian school system, the Prussian model. Right. And there's a lot of people written a lot about that and how that came about. But the compulsory education school system was, I think, developed first in the East Coast, Northeast, and it was pretty much advocated by people who were working for the industrialists who wanted to make sure that the education system produced reliable workers and not thinkers. And that's why people like Rockefeller gave like $180 million like in 1905 or something, $180 million to the General Education Board. And this went out and is, I think they helped form the, you know, the PTA. They helped form teachers' unions, and they were behind the large movement towards centralization of school systems in the first half of the 20th century. And the whole idea of sort of universal standards that we see today, the Common Core, that was a Rockefeller idea. And so that was a process that they started, because, again, they wanted workers, not thinkers. And they realized when they were making a lot of money with petroleum that they needed to leverage their wealth politically and socially. And they started – this is when they started the Rockefeller Foundation. And they more or less practiced their philanthropy. The real strategy behind their philanthropy was gaining much more social control under the guise of philanthropy. And this is why they started giving money to the arts and the theater, and also endowing universities with large sums of cash. And if that failed, they would start their own universities. You know, whole things like sociology itself came out of Chicago University, which was a Rockefeller project. Yeah. And sociology itself, the whole idea behind sociology is creating a science that facilitates social engineering. You know.
Yeah, Rockefeller seems to have a lot of connections there. He's also behind the women's lib movement, as put out there by Aaron Russo, who was one of the friends of one of the Rockefellers. I can't recall, but essentially the thought process behind that was to get women out of the home, to break down a traditional family, but then also so that the New World Order could tax the women going into the workforce now. So it's brilliant, you know. You
think Nicholas Rockefeller, yeah.
Yeah. You think it's all, you know, lovey-dovey on the surface level, but you have to know and understand they have agendas behind these particular programs. And then we have kind of like the modern-day Rockefeller. We got Soros now, who seems to have his hand in everything, you know, ranging from the Vatican to these anti-Trump Soros-funded movements. I mean, it's just – it runs really deep. Now, one question I failed to ask when we were talking about the whole notion of the sexualized society was maybe we could talk about the CIA role in it. I know you've had some guests on talking about that. Maybe you could bring in even drugs and how this relates to mind control, MK Ultra. I mean, take it however you like this, but it seems to me that the CIA plays a pretty significant role in kind of moving people out of a Christian society.
Yeah, the CIA, because you understand what the CIA represents. CIA isn't really an intelligence agency. The CIA really is more of a culture. It's more of a culture controlling agency. They're more interested in anthropologists and economists and cartologists and psychologists. The forces behind the CIA. Well, who created the CIA? The CIA developed out of the Office of Strategic Services and other wartime intelligence agencies, Office of War Information and things like that, World War II. But the OSS itself was sometimes referred to as Oso-Social, because the people that formed the nucleus of the OSS were America's – they came out of America's elite families, the East Coast establishment. And these were bankers, sons of bankers, people who ran the corporations. So it grew out of the sort of the powerful financial elite, because they represented the banks and the international corporations, which relied on the USS and CIA to advance their interest overseas. basically what these agencies were and are an attempt, a successful attempt to socialize the risks of overseas investment for a handful of corporations and a few very wealthy families. And they sort of wrap it in the flag and call it defending America, defending freedom, fighting the Cold War, you know, whatever. So that's how you have to understand the intelligence community. Same largely with the military too. I mean, you're familiar with Smedley Butler's remarks regarding what he was really doing. He was a muscle man and a collection agent, you know, for Wall Street, for Brown Brothers, Harriman, and National City Bank, and these things. So that's how you have to understand that's the true mission of these agencies. They're an agency acts on behalf of someone or something, and they're acting on behalf of the Anglo-American financial elite. Same thing you probably goes for, you know, MI6 or French intelligence, you know, or even the Mossad, which is sort of part of this Anglo-American Zio empire that we live under.
Now, staying within the realm of social engineering and cultural programming, you know, I've always argued this, we're a very distracted society. It seems like, you know, we turn on the TV rather than praying, you know, we're turning on the TV. We're always looking for the latest gadget and gadget. Talk a little bit about the role of, well, I guess we can get into mainstream media too, but I was thinking specifically as it relates to these celebrities who oftentimes are under some type of, you know, brainwashing program, whether it's MKUltra, Project Monarch. And ultimately, they're used by this nefarious elite to get across their agendas. And it seems like, you know, you see the young kids today, they're turning on the TV, and if they think their, you know, favorite celebrity, you know, dyed their hair rainbow colored, that they should do it. And it's really sad to see. It's really sad to see and witness how people like this can literally change the moral code, you know, of a society. Maybe talk a little bit more about mainstream media and specifically celebrities, how, you know, their role is playing out currently in the modern world.
Yeah, I mean, this, because I didn't really quite answer your first your question before that regarding.
Go ahead, finish up.
The culture, and you, and this has been documented. This is goes back to MK Ultra, which began under, I think it was roughly in the 1950s. MK Ultra was a mass psychological experiment. How do you study and alter human behavior? More learned accounts have, you know, mind-controlled assassins, and that may very well be true. But the broader gender, MK Ultra was engaging in mass mind control, mass mind manipulation through various things, whether it's the promotion of drugs, and we saw that with the Time Life promotion of psychedelic drugs in 1957, beginning in 1957, a decade before the Summer of Love, but also with the CIA's OSS and the CIA's involvement in the international drug trade and how that factors into the economy. That's still very important today. Doug Valentine does an excellent work on that. But they were very interested in changing the culture, introducing changing sexual mores, things, and that's why they promoted people like Alfred Kinsey. And Alfred Kinsey, right after World War II, his studies were promoted, although they were very dubious, and in fact his methodology wasn't only dubious, it was criminal, because it involved pedophilia, but his work was there to sort of gradually, I think, create the academic acceptance or preparing the academic field for the acceptance of homosexuality and pedophilia. And then gradually the culture followed it with pop culture. And this was done with the promotion of the teenager, promotion of the teenager, and then the promotion of certain types of music, particularly rock music in the 60s. Yeah. And, you know, Chris Dave McGowan's work with Laurel Canyon and the connection to the premier rock bands in the 60s to military intelligence and these things. Same thing also in Britain with the Tavistock Institute and their connections to some of the big bands over there, whether it's the Who or the Beatles. This isn't to say that there wasn't a business angle to it. There wasn't people don't want to make money off this and then entertainment itself. But there's always these connections, a social engineering angle to it. These bands were there to promote drug use, to promote sexual license. Now, with I'm sorry, what was the question you had to follow up with that?
Yeah, just maybe break down mainstream.
Oh, celebrities.
Yeah, celebrities.
And this is a big part of creating the cult of celebrity, which goes, I think, as far back as Edward Bernays. I think Enrico Caruso was promoted by him. back in the 20s, the opera singer. But his notion of the celebrity was sort of a recreation of the pantheon of the Greek gods. And he said you create a star, the whole idea of the star. And if you create these celebrities, put them on the big screen where they're larger than life, through these avatars, if you will, on the screen, they could alter human behavior, whether it's promote a war. You know, Jimmy Stewart doing ads for the Army Air Corps, telling boys, if you join the Army Air Corps, not only do you get to fly a plane, you get pretty girls. You know, you might get blown out of the sky, and you might incinerate 10,000 people, but you get a pretty nice-looking uniform, and you get a girlfriend. You know, so these things. So the promotion of celebrity culture itself, and that itself is, again, part of this, I think, you mentioned earlier, this promotion of narcissism. Because you could promote, the whole idea of everyone can become a star right now with selfies and Facebook and narcissism and these things. So that's an old project, but again, you could change the morality, and you did, and that was done through the movies, through Hollywood. And there's always been a close connection between Hollywood, the cinema, even the stage, and the powers that be, the oligarchs who really control things.
Yeah, that's just it. You know, the Catholic Church used to be in the limelight there, being the truth, if you will, transmitting the truth that Christ brought down. And now we seemingly have the TV. You know, the TV has replaced Catholicism, these celebrities who are now often, quote-unquote, synonymous with truth, so you can get some knucklehead on there, you know, promoting birth control or promoting what other lawless behavior they want to promote. And, you know, young children will equate that with truth and go out there and think they're cool by doing it. And that's how you can easily break down a Christian society. I don't know if you have any more to add to that. We could get more into maybe within the realm of advertising. If there's another area even in the entertainment industry that we're missing, perhaps. But I could just tell you this with mainstream media, Timothy. I think this is kind of their last-ditch effort as it relates to this whole fake news nonsense that they're trying to sway people away from websites like mine and yours. It seems like kind of like a last-ditch effort to say, hey, you know, they're not carrying the truth. We're the ones that, you know, only carry the truth. And then we can build off of that maybe if you want to. So this information war that we find ourselves in.
Oh, yeah, well, the whole fake news meme, that kind of has gone out there sort of like conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Did in the aftermath of the Warren Report, and it was done to sort of marginalize critics of the Warren Report and also intimidate not so much the conspiracy theorists themselves, but those people who were kind of on the fence on listening to it. I don't want to be a crazy conspiracy theorist, you know. So it's sort of created pressure to not to consider it, to take it seriously. And the fake news meme went out there, I think, I guess either just before or just after the election,
right,
to blame, you know, the internet for misleading a bunch of people.
Well, then the leftist infatuation with Russia too, right?
Yeah, the idea that Russia hacked. I don't know what they mean by hacking the election, because do they mean like that they hacked machines and were able to, confect votes for Trump? Or do they mean by hacking the emails, they're able to find, you know, get in these emails of John Podesta, some other Democrats, and the Clinton campaign and the DNC, and expose them for the crooks that they are, thereby affecting people's views and thereby changing their votes. I don't know. If the Russians were behind that, then we owe Putin and company a big thank you, because they just informed the public, kept the public informed. So I don't know what they mean by that. I think it's ridiculous. I think if the obvious source for the hacking was probably, the NSA or something.
Yeah. So, I don't know what it is. Their stories keep changing on that. I mean, who knows? It just becomes, one story after another. But, you know, we do have to report on it, keep people informed. Now, I know you
I mean, people like Brian Williams and Dan Rather talking about fake news. I mean, the ultimate irony of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it. They've been caught with their hands in the cookie jar so often, it becomes ridiculous. But, I just can see a day wherein maybe they gain some kind of control, kick all the conservative slaps, Christian websites offline or whatever, and then all you'll have on the internet is just liberal news. As crazy as that sounds, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. But one of the agendas I know you wanted to talk about, and certainly we cover here at Tradcat Night, is this whole normalization, you know, of sodomy, of the transgenders, and now the pedophiles. My goodness, that's one that I really hits home. I didn't even think they would go quite so far, but it seems now they're trying to paint certain pedophiles as virtuous pedophiles. And maybe we could talk a little bit more about this area and, you know, what they're trying to accomplish with this.
Well, I suspect what's going on, obviously we've had this normalization of sexual perversion for decades, particularly the homosexual rights movement, which broke out in the late 60s, early 70s, in the aftermath of the Stonewall riots. Now, of course, the backstory behind the Stonewall riots is that the Stonewall Bar was a hub for child trafficking and drugs, which is why it was being raided. But certain mythology has arisen around Stonewall that, you know, the police went in there and roughed everyone up, and there was a counterattack, hence the riots, and this was the start of this conscientious gay rights movement. Of course, a lot of this had foundation funding and backing and promotion. It had been gradually promoted in the media. It picked up in the 70s, homosexuality. Anyway, this goes back to cultural Marxism, because if you want to undermine society's sexual mores, you don't present the philosophical argument in behalf of homosexuality. You just start making presenting homosexual characters, sympathetic homosexual characters on television and movies. They did that with comedy, with drama in the 70s and 80s. You know, and you present them as being very sympathetic, decent people, and the people who don't understand them as being sort of neurotic or crazy. And if you watch shows like Will and Grace, things like that, where, you know, the character there was, you know, handsome, he was smart, he was always there for Grace and these things, and the neurotic characters, the ones that weren't comfortable with homosexuality, as if that was the problem. So you had this, a media campaign to normalize it for decades, and this has worked rather well, because now most people are either take a very benign view of it or actually take a very positive view of homosexuality, hence the term homophobe. If you articulate a view which, you know, 25, 30 years ago we would consider rather normal, that it's wrong or sinful and natural, and it's the sin that did not speak its name. And now it's the sin that doesn't shut up. You can't get away from it. It's everywhere. Yeah. And this is a sort of a progression where if you sort of decry its promotion in schools or in the media, you are declared a homophobe. You know, this sort of this neologism that's been developed. They're pathologizing a position which I think is both morally and philosophically appropriate. It violates the natural law, it violates the moral law, and also violates Immanuel Kant's principle of the imperative, what's the term they call it again?
It slips my mind right now, Tim, but I know a train of thought you're...
Yeah, basically, it states that if something is universally applied and it leads to destruction, then it's not defensible. And obviously, if everyone practiced homosexuality, society would collapse. It's not defensible. So, you know, that isn't to say that we're, as human beings, we have to tolerate, and we mean by tolerate, very meaning you have to respect someone's civil liberties. You know, but it doesn't mean you have to go out and promote it and accept it. And we've gotten to the point where it's considered now, if you're not sufficiently in support of homosexuality, you are thereby a homophobe, and you must be contrite and confess, or rectify
yourself.
Along
those same lines, I was thinking about that today, Tim. You know, along the same lines, just how, you know, at one point it was the quote unquote cool.
Oh, sorry. It's the categorical imperative.
Okay, there you go. Came back. We live in a society now, talking about the rise of censorship and who ultimately is behind the control of media. You know, we take a look, and when I go on these radio shows, there's a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment. You know, a lot of radio show callers calling in to ask me questions, and you just see they're just, I mean, they're just anti-Catholic, anti-Catholic this. And if you go out and try to expose international Jewry, you're seen as the outsider, whereas, you know, in medieval times it was completely opposite. I mean, it was the quote-unquote, you know, norm to be Catholic, and it kind of exposed the things that we were exposing today, where now we're kind of like on the outside. So it goes to show you, you know, who truly is behind mainstream media, and that kind of just follows up on the point that, that Tim was trying to make. So where does this end? And within the realm of the culture of death, I call it the disease of me, you know, this cult of man that's ever pervasive now in the mainstream church. You know, we got pornography, immodesty, abortion, homosexuality, pedophilia, birth control even. How far will they push the envelope here? I mean, we're talking, you know, marrying inanimate objects, you know, legalizing bestiality, you know.
They will push it until someone pushes back. And you meant, you know, this, the goal is narcissism, and some have said narcissism is Satanism, and the worship of self. I think there, you know, look at this transgender issue. 5 years ago, it would have been absurd to someone to argue that that someone who identifies as the opposite sex, has a right to go into locker rooms and bathrooms of women because they happen to identify as a female, despite the fact that they're biologically male. Now that's being seriously entertained. I came across the term transphobe the other day.
Oh boy!
You know, so where does it go? And now adults who take them so seriously are now having to debate this matter when it's prima facie absurd. It's an absurd position to take.
Yeah.
You know. But this all goes back to, I think it all stems from the issue of homosexuality, because homosexuality itself is obviously wrong. It's unnatural, and but this also goes back to the misunderstanding of what sex is all about. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church traditionally taught that sex had to be both unitive and procreative, meaning a couple had to be married and had to be open to procreation. Now, what that did was it built in restraint and understanding of the natural law. But as soon as that was broken with contraception and then abortion, this is the natural progression of things. This is the reductio ad absurdum of the liberal world order.
Yeah.
You know, consumerism run amok. I can choose whatever I want. I can even choose my sex.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, I just did a late-breaking story on that from some woman who was born a woman, now a man, but now wants to go back to a woman. I mean, it's just like, you know, these people can't even figure out, you know, what path they do want to choose.
Well, look at this whole pronoun issue.
Yeah.
Where you're misidentifying. Colleges,
yeah.
Misidentifying. You've caught people to think, talk about narcissism run amok, that people are getting offended because you can't get the pronouns correct. And they're coming up with 30, 40 different pronouns. And even, I think New York City has a law which fines people if you misidentify someone. This is how insane it is. This is a violation of free speech anyway. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Jordan Peterson, I think the Canadian professor, has talked a lot about this.
Yeah, it's popping up in colleges all over the country. Now, another area that I know that you and I share some commonality is, you know, just the covering, you know, false flags, contrived wars. I think you and I would agree. We know who's behind, you know, revolution, false flags, and wars. And what their end game is. But we have specifically Albert Pike, you know, mentioning these three world wars as kind of a blueprint. And obviously World War One and World War Two have happened now. World War Three, it is indicated that essentially it's, you know, Israel versus the Arab community. Then there's just countries that kind of, you know, pick and choose side. I would also throw the whole Russia-Ukraine situation in there with the message of Fatima and how Father Malachi Martin said to pay attention to the Kiev area and how we're seeing, you know, U.S. and NATO troops being built up there. I think that could also be a spark. You know, talk a little bit more about contrived wars, but my specific question for you is, in your opinion, you know, how much longer do we have to all-out war? That's actually my poll question for this quarterly, and it seems like as of right now, 35% are saying that in 1 year or more that we'll be, you know, neck deep in World War III, but there's still some others, 25%, 6 months to a year. You know, where do you think we're at with that? I mean, obviously, we know that's kind of the last straw. You know, we still have a little bit more to go here. Do you think it's more imminent than that?
Well, the first thing to understand when we're talking about wars, in this case, modern warfare, at least in the last century, all wars have been started based on lies. That's the one thing you have to realize when you study war. Everything you were told in the history books, the textbooks, the History Channel, the standard accounts are lies. The First World War, you know, was built on lies. And the reason why we went to war was not to make the world safe to democracy. It was to bail out J.P. Morgan and the Wall Street interests who had underwritten the Anglo-French war effort. Germany needed to be defeated. And also to fulfill the Balfour Declaration, and that was the Jewish influence in America that was enabled to get the Woodrow Wilson administration to drive the country into war. Second World War, going to war again on behalf of the British Empire and also for Anglo-American interests throughout the world. Same thing, but what Charles Lindbergh said in 1941 was essentially correct. It was the British, the FDR administration, and the Jewish power in the United States that was dragging the country into war. In fact, they admit that. It's just when he said it, it was considered anti-Semitic for some reason. Same with the Cold War. It was contrived. It was it developed out of the decisions taken during the Second World War, particularly unconditional surrender. But it was fully expected that Stalin would get half of Europe and there'd be the Iron Curtain and these things.
Right.
The wars within the Cold War, Korea and Vietnam, were based on lies. Same thing with the War on Terror. The current War on Terror is based on lies.
Now, do you see the War on Terror? I'm curious because I know we cover this the same. Do you kind of see it the same way I see it in terms of the War on Terror kind of solidifying the police state? I mean, it seems like you turn on the nightly news, there's attack. In one country, it doesn't even have to be in our country. It could be in another country. And all of a sudden, now the airports are, ramped up with more boots on the ground. It just seems to me to be another way to normalize the police state as to, this is our protection. No longer, is Christ our protection. No longer, is the church once being a protector of truth. But now it's like we're spinning everything back onto the state or spinning it back onto the police state saying, hey, you're the ones to protect us. I mean, that's quite dangerous, obviously. But, I mean, do you kind of see it the same way?
Yeah, it's a strategy of tension. And it's been done. It's been documented. It's a question of how it's applied today. I mean, obviously, we have the examples of Gladio in Europe.
Right.
So these false flag attacks to change the political environment towards the right, away from the left, and by staging these fake terrorist attacks that were blamed on communist groups in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. A similar thing probably happened with 9/11, where you have patsies put up there to take the fall, more or less, and blame this broad group of Muslim terrorists, and that would justify. Of course, that justified what Department of Homeland Security. It justifies us being people being manhandled and molested at airports by TSA goons.
That's it.
It justifies the open admission of surveillance that probably existed prior to it. But there's sort of this out and about, sort of this admitted total surveillance society. Obviously what's done in schools with the drills, not just the occasional shootings, which I think are highly dubious, but the drills themselves, which are designed to condition students into being fearful and also to being checked by police all the time, which some people have referred to it as the school-to-prison project. Schools have lockdowns and all the psyop of all that. So, yeah, I think the war on terror is the forever war. And I think James Madison had some things to say about the threat of war and freedom. The two can't exist side by side. And if you have a continual war, you're going to have an erosion and just ultimate destruction of any notion of government, limited government, and constitutional rule of law. Because in an emergency, you can always break the Constitution in the name of the emergency. And so, but if you give politicians and that out, that excuse, they're always going to be declaring emergencies. And that's sort of been the history of this country, with declaring emergencies. The moment the emergencies declare it, they shred the Constitution.
Yeah, and they've even, brainwashed us to kind of redefine who who is a terrorist, really? I mean, let's be honest with us. I mean, it's now your patriot types, you know, just Christians in general. Anyone who questions the mainstream narrative, you know, is a terrorist. And ultimately, folks, listen, I am one of those quote-unquote conspiratorial types that thinks that there is a connection between the upcoming martial law in this country and FEMA camps. I think there is something to be said there. It's also biblical from a perspective that we know in the end times that Christians will ultimately be beheaded. I think there's guillotines being set up now all over the country. I mean, there's connection there, folks. I mean, something for you all to investigate. I don't know if you want to add on that point, Tim, just in terms of just the notion of terrorism. Maybe we can get into a little bit more of the disease of liberalism, what you're seeing in this area, maybe some guests that you've had on to break down just liberalism in general. There's one traditional Catholic bishop that insinuated that it's not only an error, it's a religion. He called it the religion of liberalism, and we're just neck deep in liberalism this day. It's really hard. I don't know if you've ever seen those Mark Dice videos where he goes out and onto the streets and he starts interview. I mean, it's like, really? I mean, I can't believe these people exist. I mean, I do, but not to the level that I'm quite seeing with Mark Dice's producing, and they are out there. I mean, people supporting, you know, men's, you know, urinals in the women's bathroom. Yeah, I think that should happen. I mean, just it's just madness that we're living in.
Yeah, it's again, it's the problem of that is you're getting back into something where you're questioning the entire founding or experiment that we call America, and that rubs people the wrong way because they like to be patriotic and think. Kindly, they think if we just move back to some, you know, golden era where America was better, you know, healthier, and this is all we need to do is bring back the founding fathers and everything will be okay and all that. But philosophically speaking, I think the era was probably the development of the Renaissance and humanism, philosophically speaking. This put this enthroned man and killed God. And once you kill God, you no longer have a standard, and man becomes the measure of all things. And it's sort of there's an unfolding process that develops. It's an unfolding drama, and that's what we're seeing today. This is why many I would say libertarians, a group of with whom I have a large area of agreement with on many particular issues, miss the point on this. The importance of community, the importance of family, and how libertarianism itself might be part of a dialectic that was created, same way that Marxism was, and how Karl Marx himself was a libertarian, you know, the erosion of the state. And so the problem is if you destroy tradition, if you destroy institutions like church, and you challenge traditional authority, proper authority like family, you expose the individual out there. You leave them naked before the corporate state. And this is the dialectic. And this is why I think we've had the assault on the church and in the media. This is why we hear about pedophilia in the Catholic Church, but you don't hear about it in Hollywood. Yeah. You don't hear we get glimpses of it in politics like Henry like Denny Hastert, but there's no real investigation or wide investigation of into the deeper implications of, you know, the third most powerful man in the country was a pedophile. What does that suggest? Or that Hollywood is so infested with pedophilia that it defines the industry. Yet we hear talks, you know, we hear this Catholic Church, because if you delegitimize the Catholic Church, particularly in sexual matters, because the Catholic Church is one of the few institutions that's maintaining standards on sexual issues, you can justify all the hedonism and all the narcissism out there, because, heck, if priests are doing this stuff, then I'm not so bad, and I don't have to go to church anymore because the Catholic Church is so corrupt.
Yeah, and it puts us to shame. It turns people away. I know an awful lot of Catholics on the basis of that who have actually left the Catholic faith on the basis of that, and that is by no means a reason to leave the faith. But, yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, they want to, you know, right now, we are on the level of the new humanism of Vatican II. I've said that the next thing is secular humanism. They want secular humanism across the board, you know, a church free of dogma. And this is what, in my opinion, Our Lady of La Salette was warning about, something for us to keep an eye on here in the next few years. My next question for you, and feel free to add, you know, upon that comment if you'd like, but as it relates to the United States, I mean, where are we headed? break down the elections a little bit. What are you seeing? Can Trump, really stave off globalism, if you will? Are we headed for inevitable economic collapse, revolution? I mean, what do you see happening in this year, but just potentially throughout his whole term, if he makes it that far? And this is where we can get into more conspiratorial talk, where maybe he gets assassinated. I don't know.
Well, I think what Trump represented, and I've talked to a number of people about this, I think it seems to make sense, is that Trump was allowed to throw his hat into the ring. Obviously, elections don't decide who is president, but elections are – you can get – basically what I'm saying is you can probably get more out of looking at who – what choices are we given in these elections rather than who decides to run in the elections. The American people aren't really choosing these people. It's whoever gets to whoever gets covered in the media and whoever is enabled to – whoever is nominated by the party. And that's more of a – that's a decision that's taken by the oligarchs. And I think Trump at one point represented perhaps – a ringer to go in there and ensure that Hillary Clinton was elected. And I think somewhere along the a line, it was determined that either she was too corrupt or too sick to be a reliable, puppet in the White House. Mm-hmm. And elements within the deep state, national security state, started leaking things to weaken Hillary's campaign. The health issue became a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy theory turned into real news. And for a while, you're a conspiracy nut if you thought Hillary was too sick. And all of a sudden, it started being treated seriously because of the videotapes we all saw of her collapsing in New York City on 9/11 of all days. Yes. But I think Trump represented a faction within the elite that might – and I'm putting a positive spin on this stuff. I'm thinking that perhaps there's an element that says we need to take a step back. We need to reverse policies in some areas, maybe to reinvest in the United States, sort of a reindustrialization. This is a sort of a reversal of 30, 40 years that the globalists have been doing since late 60s, when they opened up to China and they destroyed the Bretton Woods system and started developing China. So there might be some sort of retrenchment going on here. That's what Trump represents. If you go into Trump's pedigree, he comes from casinos and hotels, and that's traditionally what we call the mafia. Even his company, Resorts International, traces right back to Mario Lansky and the CIA, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
So now I understand how they all worked in tandem. That industry took a big hit under Obama, particularly Obamacare, because Obamacare took a big chunk out of everyone's disposable income. And so maybe they said, we need to reverse policy a little bit. That's why we're hearing talk of Obamacare being repealed, which actually might happen. So on the short term, it may be some positive aspects to this. Now, I don't think we're going to get a general collapse because I think if I were looking at the economic fundamentals, I'd say yes. But I don't think you can apply economic analysis to what's going on because the system is so rigged. If they want to collapse, they can have a collapse, I guess. If they want a slow burn, they can have a slow burn. If they want to manipulate it somehow, because the whole banking system, international monetary system, is so rigged that it's hard to apply any market analysis to what's going on. I mean, the dollar should have collapsed decades ago if that were the case.
Well, I guess the only point I would bring up is, if this nefarious character is kind of on the horizon, this Maitreya character I've been warning everyone about, they make it quite clear that there will be a collapse and that he'll show up after the fact, because ultimately they want to move people into this digital economy. They want to move people into this one world socialist republic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if they completely collapse it, it makes sense that they would be able to do it. I mean, if they kind of just half-ass it, pardon the expression, I mean, I'm not quite sure that they would get everyone on board with that program. So,
I say there might be some pushback. I mean, I'm saying there might be elements within real resistance to that type of program.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And,
you're definitely, if you look at technology and the fact that, well over 95% of all transactions are electronic, cash has been heavily marginalized, and the fact that we do live via the internet, we are all surveilled to the digital technology. They've you know, taken a huge leap in that direction.
Yeah, and even with Trump, it seems like that's the direction it's going to go. You know, the surveillance state will only continue to increase. That's another area.
I mean, it's could be more effective. It's a turnkey, as I think it was Frank Church called it that back in the 70s when he was uncovering, in that limited hangout, he was uncovering some of the transgressions of the CIA. And his, what was exposed regarding surveillance back then, and he said that something I really fear that what we'll be facing very soon is a turnkey totalitarian state.
Yeah.
And that's what we're facing today, I think, if we're not there already. We just don't know it.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. Well, appreciate it, Tim, for coming on. It's hard to believe we've just gone through an hour. Like, what I like to do with all my guests is to provide the last few minutes here for you to do some shameless self-promotion. Maybe you can give us a look a little bit into the future of some future guests, upcoming shows, projects you're working on, and just maybe talk a little bit more about your podcast again, and I'll close it out.
Oh, thank you. My podcast is Our Interesting Times. It is listener-supported, and I do have a donate button there if some people want to be, and people have been generous, and it helps justify the effort I put into it, particularly with my wife. When I get a little financial support for it, help justify the expenses that it involves and also the time. I have a couple interviews planned. One is I have one with Lance DeHaven Smith. He's one that wrote Conspiracy Theory in America that I have coming up soon. I look forward to that. And I also have one dealing with the Jack Cashel, who wrote a book on TWA 800 that I'll be posting soon. The true story behind that air disaster.
Okay.
And it's Our Interesting Times on YouTube, and so it's there on the podcast. Just Google it, you'll find it.
Absolutely. Good stuff, Tim. Just as you mentioned, it definitely helps in the area of financial support. I just wanted to thank all those who have continued to support TradCat Night financially. I hope that you all do consider doing so, as Tim mentioned, just with anything that you're doing, whether it's a church, whether it's a business. I mean, there are upfront costs. So I always just say, we go and grow as your charity flows. So please get behind this apostle if you can. And I try to bring the best possible guests on. Again, a lot of requests for Tim to come on the show today. And again, there's a lot of commonality between what Tim is covering on a daily basis and what we are here at TradCat Night. And the more qualified individuals we can get on the show, better programming, better insights. And that's what we're trying to do here at TradCat Night. So again, I think 2017 is going to be quite eventful. That's just my own take. We'll see how this plays out with Trump and everything. But I just wanted to continue to remind everyone that as things do get worse, in my opinion, things are going to get worse, to not fall into that pit of despair, doubt, worry, that ultimately we know through the Blessed Virgin Mary that her Immaculate Heart would reign in the world, and that's what we need to be focused in on. Yes, the storm is coming, but we need to stay focused on the rainbow on the other side of that storm. And I encourage you all to check out Tim's podcast, Our Interesting Times. A lot of good guests. Again, he's had on Dr. E. Michael Jones, I think actually even more so than we have on this show, and he provides a lot of great insights. So maybe we'll get him back on soon too. And
you said despair. I think despair is what Satan wants us to do.
Yeah.
And remember, Judas's ultimate the downfall wasn't his betrayal of Christ. It was the despair he felt afterwards.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tim. And like I said, I just see that with a lot of Catholics. As a matter of fact, when I was on the radio show today, someone had called in and mentioned that. Like, he was a one-time Catholic, and because of, what was going on in the church, he left. Well, that's not a reason to leave the church. I mean, now's the time to draw a line in the sand and say, no, we're going to stand here and fight. We're going to continue to resist. And those will be the true saints of our times, not going along with the godless modern world, but raising up as eagles, taking a stand. And as I say, faith over fear. Flight over fright, folks. Let's keep our wings spread as eagles. And until next time, my good friends, stay safe and God bless.